You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to he's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 50 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. And what better way to celebrate a milestone of 50 episodes than some of the games that we had today? All the games were amazing. Every single one of them. We had four games, and it was just one of those days that it was glorious to be an NBA fan. But before we get into the games, there's something I do have to mention, and if you watch the games today, you would have realized that we only had two time slots for the four games. So we had two games going on at once all throughout the evening, right? So what that means, and I'm not trying to make excuses, I'm just providing full disclosure, what that means is I was watching both games at once for all four games. So I was trying to give certain games undivided attention when there was timeouts and stuff like that, but when they were both running. So if I did miss out on little points such as player names or, you know, who made a shot at the 2:34 mark of the second quarter, I apologize, but I did the best that I could. I was making notes. I was trying my best and I'm referring to the box scores. But yeah, there's only so much one person can do when they're recapping this stuff. But let's get straight into the action. And let's kick things off by talking about the Thunder and Jazz Game 5. Oklahoma came out playing well, but you could tell their confidence was shaken a little. Utah, on the other hand, they looked calm and methodical. Jay Crowder was having the game of his life, or at least his playoff life. And it was very impressive because typically on the road in closeout situations, you need veterans to step up and set the tone of the game and produce well. And that's what Jay Crowder was doing. Along with Crowder, Joe Ingles was contributing, and Westbrook was quiet. All of these factors added up to a 25-point lead for Utah early in the third quarter. Somehow, and after Game 4, I didn't think this was possible at all, but Oklahoma had reached a new low. And honestly, it looked like the Thunder had conceded mentally. And you could tell by the crowd, which is might sound like a really simplistic way to look at it, but the Thunder has won of the more vocal and loyal fan bases in the entire NBA, and they were as silent as I have ever heard them. And they seem resigned to the fact that this was the last game we're going to see of the Thunder this season. But with some different rotations, i.e. Anthony on the bench, the Thunder's rotations and ball pressure and their energy lifted. Westbrook and George came to life, and they went on a 23-2 run and tied the game just before the end of the third. I've seen a lot of basketball in my life, and I'll be honest with you, I have never, ever, ever seen a quarter quite like that one. The Thunder were dead in the water, and that revival was something special. Down the stretch in the fourth quarter, Westbrook and George continued their amazing play, but Steven Adams deserves a lot of credit because he was delivering big screen after big screen for those guys. And you might be thinking, well, hold on a second, that's a pretty obscure thing to be talking about, just screens. He's been doing that his entire career. But he was so effective with these in the fourth quarter, it prevented Gobert and the original defender from jumping the ball handler. So Gobert, or whoever was guarding Adams most of the time, was Gobert in the fourth quarter. He was plagued with foul trouble before that. But in the fourth, it was mainly Gobert. They were isolated on these guys, and they were able to get into a wonderful rhythm. And from the point I mentioned, they were down 25 points in the third quarter. From that point, the Thunder had a 33-point turnaround. I talked the other day about how historic it was with the Houston Rockets having a 50-point quarter and holding the Timberwolves to 30. It was around a little bit more of an extended period, but a 33-point turnaround is even bigger than a 30-point difference that the Rockets had. And the pressure in this situation was even more dramatic because, okay, if the Rockets lose Game 4, had they had lost Game 4, the series is tied at 2 games apiece. The Thunder were down 3-1. If they didn't respond, they're done. They're history. And a lot of these players, as I mentioned before, especially Westbrook, their careers are forever tarnished by the fact that they just got eviscerated by a rookie and Ricky Rubio. And before the game, I predicted a big game for Westbrook, and he finished with 45. George had 34, and Utah collapsed. Now, as impressive as it was, reality does check in as they have to go to Utah for another elimination game. You got to ask, will there be a hangover? There's a vacuum, an emotional vacuum after such a high, after such... How much did they put in? Of course, they had to. They didn't have a choice. If they didn't put that run together, we'd be talking... The direction of this conversation, we'd be talking about how good Utah's looking now as they go into battle against Houston. But a better question might be, how will Utah respond? Are they going to be able to recover after letting this get away? You can expect Game 6 to be the game of the series, because both teams will have everything to play for. Utah will view this as their best opportunity. Well, maybe not. They were just up by 25 points. But playing in Game 6 in Utah is better than playing Game 7 back in Oklahoma. So Utah will view this as a must-win, whereas Oklahoma, this actually is a must-win. It is. They've got two more must-wins. That's why 3-1 deficits are so hard to come back from. But with that pressure, there will also be a sense of, you know, a fresh sense of life here, because they've got a second chance. Redemption almost. But Utah is a hostile environment. Let's not forget that. If Oklahoma plays like they did in the first half and early in the third quarter, or even if you all go back a little bit further in the fourth quarter and the second half of game four, they're going to be history. There's no way they can come back from that in that environment. But it's going to be incredible to watch. Don't expect a whole lot of changes this deep into a playoff series either. Utah's probably thinking, hey, we had these guys on the ropes, and it took not just Westbrook, but it took Steven Adams playing amazing, and I mentioned Paul George's numbers. He was incredible down the stretch as well. Let's not forget him. I do see Oklahoma maybe shortening the minutes for Carmelo and putting him in shorter spurts. But both teams know each other so well at this point, it's going to come down to execution and just intensity. And it's going to be wonderful. Who handles the pressure the best? And this is what I love about playoff basketball. And this is why I think playoff basketball, in the NBA at least, is the best out of all the major sports. It's because, okay, you've got other seven-game series formats, like baseball and ice hockey. But with ice hockey, if your goalie gets hot, he can control the series. In baseball, your pitchers are rotating, so it's not the same guy every single time. With basketball, it's the same team, barring injuries, of course. It's the same guys, the same rotations, typically, for a seven-game series. You know each other like the back of your hand. That's why it's so rare that the better team doesn't win a seven-game series. And then, of course, you've got American football or college basketball, where it's one and done. And that's great in of itself. But you get far too many upsets. And some people like that. And I get why you like that, because it's unpredictable. But I prefer to see the best team advancing and the chess match developing in front of our eyes. And if it sounds like I'm excited, I am. That was amazing. That was so cool to watch. And it's not because I don't like Utah. I like Utah a lot. If you listened to the podcast early on, you would have heard me rave about Donovan Mitchell early on when he had that 40-point performance. I said this was a special player. And if Utah comes back and wins this series, they will have survived a gut check. I love it when I see teams challenged and tested and how they perform under pressure. Because it's no good just sweeping mediocre competition, the teams that give up. Because what happens in the next round when they go up against Houston, a team that doesn't give up? That, you know, okay, they struggle for quarters, and we'll get to that in a minute. But overall, they just keep coming at you. You want to be tested, and you have to build that resolve. And the only way you build that resolve is by being tested. And speaking of tested, let's talk about the Cavs-Pacers series. And Indiana opened the game with great execution. With the exception of Game 2, the road team in this series has started every game very well and established double-digit leads in the first half. Game 2 is the only exception. And that turned into a close game down the stretch as well. So we've been treated to some great basketball. With the exception of Game 1, every game has been close down the stretch. This is fantastic, and I love seeing how teams respond to the pressure. What I just said about not being tested and not having to deal with pressure, and how it ill-equips you for those moments of truth, you can say that applies to LeBron totally and his run of terror in the Eastern Conference over the last 7 years. He hasn't been tested. And when he has been tested, i.e. pushed to the seventh game against Boston, and he had to deliver in Game 6 and Game 7, what happened? He won a championship. Or when he was pushed to a seventh game against the Pacers in the conference finals, what happened? He won a championship. It's when he hasn't been tested, he usually falls flat on his face in the finals. So it's great to see him tested this early in the playoffs, because despite what you might think, I don't want to see him fall flat on his face in the finals. I want to see him do well in the finals. I don't want to see him lose 4-0 or 4-1. That's terrible. I don't want to see it. That's garbage. I'd rather watch, you know, summer league basketball than that. Anyway, let's get back to the game. Sorry. Sabonis was big for the Pacers off the bench. And I've talked about Portland in the 2016 playoffs a few times. And when Lillard was doubled, they countered that by passing to Plumlee and letting him operate in the open space. This is exactly how Indiana is countering the Cavs when they jump Oladipo. And Sabonis is a lot better with the basketball than what Plumlee was. Now, Indiana led at halftime, but they had an abysmal third quarter. They only scored 17 points for the entire quarter, which was generous considering how bad they actually played. Cleveland returned the favor with 17 points themselves in the fourth quarter, but we'll get to that in a minute. The Cavs consistently called Korver's number, that's a mouthful, using a variety of screeners and plays to get him open. And while there isn't a whole lot more the Pacers can do to slow down LeBron, they do need to communicate and rotate a lot more effectively in that off-the-ball movement, because they're letting Korver get target practice, catch-and-shoot threes, and that's just asking for trouble. The Pacers made a run despite another horrid game from Oladipo. He shot 2 from 15 from the field and 2 of 7 from three-point territory. In fact, the last three games, he's 12 of 50 from the field and 5 of 25 from 3. And 2 of those were home games. Now, I know Cleveland is focusing in on him and they're not going to let him beat them single-handedly like he did in Game 1, but those are disastrous numbers. And it's been a miracle that the Pacers have been able to stay competitive despite those performances from their best player. Down the stretch of the game, it was explosive, but it was really unconventional. First, we saw Sabonis blow a layup, a shot that he's made so many times where he just sort of flips it up from his hip. If he just went straight up with it, it would have been a much better situation for him. Then LeBron, at the end of the game, he dribbled the ball out of bounds, but then he got it back on a block on Oladipo. Both of those will be talked about extensively. After about 3 offensive fouls by LeBron, Young slapped the ball out of his hands, which hit the baseline before coming back up to deflect off James and out of bounds. Now, honestly, I hate asking this question because it's so obvious at this stage, but why was this not reviewed? It clearly should have been, and it should have been Cavs' ball. Likewise happened on his block on Oladipo, which came off the glass before James got to it. Now, also with that play, why didn't Oladipo go straight up with it? He had a full step on LeBron, but instead of going straight up, he was drifting away from the basket. He was almost behind the basket when, by the time the ball got to the backboard, his momentum of his body carried him that far away. And that allowed James to catch up to it and meet it at the backboard. This set up the Cavs with the last possession, and LeBron made an amazing shot. Under pressure, there's not much else you can say beyond it. He looked calm and comfortable in this situation. And that's something you couldn't always say about him in late game situations outside of layups. And that might sound like I'm taking a shot at him, but no, it's not. It was also surprising that we didn't see much of an effort by the Pacers to get the ball out of his hands. There was 3 seconds on the clock. LeBron was able to dribble it, I think it was twice, before fading back. If you run a double at him, it might, if nothing else, put him in two minds as to whether he should pass the ball or not. And with only 3 seconds, once he's taken that second dribble, or even if it was only one dribble, a catch-and-shoot situation with a role player is... I would prefer that. And I know hindsight, but I wonder if that was even discussed by the Pacers during the timeout. Shots that big can deflate a team, but don't expect Indiana to roll over in Game 6. They have found themselves in big holes and their star struggling, but they keep fighting their way out of it and making games out of it. You can expect the same to happen in Game 6, but what you can't expect is Oladipo to actually show up. He's gotten that bad, that progressively bad. I would love for him to stand up, and I would love for this to become a 7-game series, but I've lost confidence in him to stand up and actually play well. Now, if he is struggling, I wouldn't say anything silly like bench him because he's far too valuable, and he does garner a lot of the attention for Cleveland on the defensive end of the court for them. But I would like to see, this is the same thing I said about Lillard, and I drew those comparisons early on in, when I started talking about this game. Why not put him in different situations? Why not have him starting from about 15 to 18 feet out, set a couple of down screens, have him catch the ball, have some much better screens set for him, similar to what Steven Adams was able to provide, and force him, rather than getting jumped but in those situations, have him isolated and switched onto a much bigger player. That's what I'd like to see. Right now, what they are running is not working for him. And three games in a row, as I said, two games at home as well, it's just not good enough. And they have no chance in this series unless if he plays a lot better. Now, if he does play better, though, here's the kicker. His role players, his supporting cast, are playing so well right now, and you're getting a variety of different players. We see Bogdanović and Turner and Lance Stephenson and obviously Sabonis. We've seen them all step up. So if they get some good production out of him, there's hope for them to even win this series if he's able to turn it around. But as I said before, I've lost a bit of confidence, and they do need to restructure their offense a little bit. We're going to move on to the Wizards and Raptors Game 5. And this was a gut check. This was an absolute test for Toronto. Had they lost this game, wouldn't they feel like the world is crumbling around them? Number one seed up against the Wizards. We all know this. I've talked about this quite a few times, but the Wizards are a pretty good team. They've got a good playoff history against the Raptors. They swept them a couple of years ago. And the cause, whilst obviously there's a lot of player movement, the cause of both teams are still relatively intact. And, you know, obviously Toronto, number one seed, high expectations, not just from external sources, but within themselves to at least get to the NBA Finals. Whenever you're a number one seed, that has to be the goal. And they win the first two games, they lose the next two in Washington. If they were to drop this game and then have a must-win game in Washington, otherwise they're bounced, boy, that's the kind of pressure you do not want on a team that's already emotionally fragile in the playoffs. And they were down 30-25 at one stage, but they responded well. They were led by DeRozan, who I think he had about 32 points. I wasn't able to catch that because, as I said, I was watching two games at once. It was a little bit difficult to pick up on that. But number 55 for them, right? I didn't even know much about him. But he came in playing point guard, playing a combo role. He wasn't really playing point guard because he's playing alongside Lowry. He had a huge stretch down the fourth quarter that really blew the game open for them. And it was one of those unexpected lifts, kind of like Jay Crowder or Marcus Smart in the Celtics and Bucks game we saw yesterday. And it just put them over the top. I did want to see a little bit more from Kelly Oubre and Otto Porter. John Wall, Bradley Beal played great. They didn't shoot a great percentage, but they competed. And if this series is to go seven, don't be surprised, first of all, obviously. But if it's to go seven, Washington will have a bit of confidence behind them, because in the back of their minds, they're probably thinking, well, that was a random game from Wright. I don't even know what his first name is, but from Wright. And you take that game away, and they're into it right up to their necks. So, and then all of a sudden, if this is a Game 7 situation, that's a lot of pressure, even though they'll be at home, for Toronto to deal with. And usually, this might sound like I'm contradicting myself from a minute ago when I said how much I love teams to deal with pressure. Not if they're emotionally fragile, because they can implode, and they can just shut down. But DeRozan has played so well in this series, I'm really not that concerned with it. Do I think they'll finish it off in Game 6? Yes. But if they don't finish it off in Game 6, I'm confident that they'll be able to win this series in Game 7. It'll be close. Both of these games potentially could be close. But I think Toronto does take care of business in Game 6. And speaking of taking care of business, we saw the Rockets who... You know, to the Timberwolves' credit, I didn't think they would come out with as much fight as what they did. Not after what happened to them with that. I mentioned it before, the 50-point quarter that the Rockets laid on them in game four. And I thought that really ended the series. But no, the Rockets, if you look at the end scoreline, you probably thought, well, what are you talking about? This doesn't look like a competitive game. Well, look beyond the box score. If you watch the games, you know that the Timberwolves came to play. And even though it ended in five games, the Rockets were pushed in a lot of those situations. I mean, look at game one. Look at the performance that it took for James Harden to get over the line. Look at the performance it took from all of them, but especially James Harden and Chris Paul, to win game four on the road. And then, of course, you look at what we just saw in game five. Had they dropped this game, which, you know, the game was up for grabs for a large portion of it, had they dropped this game, then all of a sudden, Minnesota's going back home with all the momentum in the world to force a game seven. So there was a lot to... They wanted to finish this early. And just like Toronto, James Harden, Chris Paul, Mike D'Antoni, all those guys, they have playoff demons too. So it was very important that they finish this off early. I'm impressed with what they've done. And outside of Philadelphia and New Orleans, they've impressed me the most, even when you take into account the fact that they've won 65 games. You would think, well, a team that won 65 games, they should win in five games in the first round. But just like Washington is not your typical 8 seed in the Eastern Conference, Minnesota is not your typical 8 seed even in the Western Conference. They're a very good team. And had you had told me at the turn of the year that Minnesota would be playing Houston in the playoffs, I would have thought easily a second round matchup, maybe even a conference finals, the way that Minnesota was rolling. One other thing I wanted to point out, it was good to see Jeff Teague respond to a little bit of criticism and pressure. He played well. I was a little bit harsh on him, but as I said, he responded well to it, and he was maybe their best player outside of Karl-Anthony Towns. And once again, it was good to see him responding a little bit. It was good to see him actually get his hands on the ball a bit. That blows me away, and that's why I think Thibodeau needs to be reevaluated as a coach. How could they not go to him more in this series? And it was also great to see Derrick Rose obviously play as well as he did throughout this series as well. I don't know what contract he signed. I know he was waived by Utah. I'm not sure if it was a one-year deal that he signed with Minnesota. If it was only a one-year deal, I'm kind of happy about that, because I want to see another team give him a shot at a starting role. I don't mean a cesspool like Cleveland or New York, because those cultures are toxic for point guards, for vastly different reasons, by the way. But those are not good environments. I would love to see him go to a situation where he can play point guard, he can get minutes, there's not a whole lot of pressure for him to score or carry the load on the offensive end throughout the regular season. But come playoff time, we all hear about playoff Rondo and all these other guys. Playoff Derrick Rose is pretty good this year. Anyway, guys, episode 50 is in the books. I do have a lot of questions. I mentioned that, but there's four games to get through. So episode 51, we only have one game to take on tomorrow, and that's Milwaukee versus Boston in game 6. I will go with Milwaukee on that, and we'll get a game 7. It wouldn't shock me if Boston wins, because Boston was very close to taking game 4 despite Milwaukee having a big lead. But it's been a great series, so I think 7th game would be... is worthy of the competitive nature we've seen so far. As I was saying, though, the next episode, we will be handling a lot of your questions. keep sending them in, because there's going to be days where we'll only have one game or no games in the playoffs, and I'll be able to handle your questions and take on some topics as well. I'll also be doing a preview of the upcoming Pelicans and Warriors series, something that I promise that I'll do. So we'll also take care of that tomorrow. But thanks so much. Thanks for your support. 50 episodes, 50 already, in a space of about, 7-8 months? That's more than I expected to do. Granted, I've done about 15 in the last 2 weeks, so that kind of counts for the surge in numbers. But thanks so much for your support. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sending the questions in. Thank you for sharing. And I look forward to catching up with you tomorrow.